shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
And believe me, Doug and I have views and opinions. I'm Nick Gardner, and this is...
Doug Jenke. How are you guys doing?
Good morning.
We've got an echo in here.
Yes.
That's okay. We can deal with it.
Carl's not controlling my mic there, Liam, so you can leave it on.
Okay.
Okay, well, today we've got a guest in the house today, and we're going to get to that in a little bit. I want you to get a pen and a piece of paper because I've got a YouTube video that you need to listen to. We're going to get ready with clip number one, and this is a lead-up to it. And Doug and I have both been saying that there's a possibility maybe Vladimir Putin is the good guy in what's going on in the Ukraine.
Yes. The evidence has been adding up that as bad as our media and our politicians paint Mr. Vladdy, he wasn't unprovoked, and he may not, when the dust settles, be the bad guy. The American system and the European system may end up being the one that caused this entire mess.
So let's take off with that clip there.
Hello, everybody. This is Paul from Off-Grid Desert Farming with Paul and Adrian. This is February the 10th, Friday, 2023. And we have a new breaking news story for you this morning, and the news is not very good, but this article just came out probably about an hour ago that Russia is now formulating a response to the revelation of the Nord Stream bombing. Seymour Hersh put out a paper about 3 days ago, we reported this, claiming that the Biden administration planned the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, and that Russia is formulating a response, and there is secret negotiations going on right now between the United States, and if the negotiations fail, they said that Russia could possibly use nuclear weapons and will give a deadline of 72 hours to the United States and NATO to evacuate the area before they drop the nuclear bomb. So let's go ahead and get going on this article, folks. You know, we've been warning about this for a very long time, that the United States has been poking the Russian bear, and now evidence has come out that they indeed had planned the Nord Stream pipeline demolition. So this is going to be, I guess, Russia's response. So what you're looking at on your screen is the article. It says Russia.
Well, there you go. That's the situation we're in. You don't see this on mainstream media. My friend Barbara sent this to me. And here's the website I want you to go to. I use DuckDuckGo. You can Google it if you want. Just Google, Ukraine is about to be annihilated. And there's a Colonel McGregor that is high up and explains the whole deal. It's 35 minutes, and it's well worth your view. What'd you think of it, Doug?
You know, when it happened and then they started blaming Russia for blowing up its own pipeline, I thought that was pretty dubious. And so I started doing research and looking and left and right, and more the intelligence was suggesting that at first it was they said the British did it, then they said Norway did it, and now according to that reporter Hersh, who has a history of breaking these stories and a history of always being right and truthful, he laid out exactly what happened and where, and Biden and his band of village idiots decided to take it out. And here's the best part, folks, is they were getting cheap Russian gas, which Trump told them not to do, but we blew up the pipeline from cheap Russian gas, and we're only charging Europe five times the previous going rate. So it wasn't a non-economic thing. We actually did it to increase our bottom line.
So I've got two other I've got a special announcement after halftime, so be sure and be back after your bathroom break for the after the commercials. Yesterday, 99.99999% of us did not die of COVID.
Nope.
And John Cooper, this is some Democrat, I don't know where he's from, New York, I think. He posted a question out on a poll. Do you agree Donald Trump should not be allowed to be buried in Arlington National Cemetery when he dies? Can you believe that?
Well, you know, they got to continually pound on Trump and forget the fact that they are destroying our country. And that's what the liberal Democrats do. And so, you know, let's now try to besmirch the man before he's dead. That's a good strategy, by the way.
So Doug's going to introduce our guest now.
Well, for a reminder for our listeners, a couple shows back, we had a lady, I believe she was an RN or a psychologist or something, if memory serves me right, and she was in the criminal justice system, and we wanted to find out, why is all of this recidivism? Why are there the repeat offenders? What about, you know, the addiction and stuff? And this lady, who's been in the system for many years, told us that basically, the system is not designed to cure anything or anybody. It just gets them to court, then they wash their hands, and they move on to the next case. So Nick and I got to talking, and we said we'd love to talk to somebody who's been through the system, washed out the other side, and actually turned their life around. So it is my honor this morning. I work with this gentleman on a day-to-day basis, and I can assure you he's one of the finest people I've met, and he's a great realtor as well. Mr. Adam Schwartz, thank you for coming on today.
Hey, good morning, Doug. Thanks, guys, for having me on. What an introduction there, huh? Doug said I'm a fine human being.
Well, I'm sure 12 years ago I probably would have had a different introduction. And so today, Adam, what we're looking to do is, you know, you can relay stories. And, folks, this gentleman, he's presented in front of the Good News Rescue Mission, their big events and stuff. So he tells his stories, and they're funny. But they tell a story. So give us a little background, Adam. How did you get into the life and get us up to speed?
Well, tell us about your life too, the one you left behind.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah,
absolutely. I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like. You know, kind of what happened, the changes that took place, and then a little bit of what it's like today. So
my guess is you had a substance abuse problem.
Several substance abuses. It
okay,
was kinda...
well, that's what we want to hear. What was your problem?
My problem was myself. I mean, anything to get me out of the way I thought and felt. You know, I really wasn't comfortable with who I was. And growing up, you know, I love both my parents. They both passed away. But my parents also struggled with drug addiction. And so I got into that lifestyle at a very young age, you know, 12, 13 years old, being exposed to that lifestyle. And I remember, you know, probably 12 or 13, you know, being told again, hey, we're getting evicted. We need to make money for rent. But we have these little baggies we can go out and sell, and then we could pay the rent if, you know, we sell enough to make the money. Now, I know people that come from the world I come from can relate. We always never paid the rent. We never paid the rent. You know, it's like we would have it, and the goal was to pay the rent, but it never worked out, you know.
Did you work for the government back then?
No. We were hiding from the government. The government was, you know, spying on us. So that was, you know, my growing up from early age, that was, we always, there was always substances in the house. There was always drugs and alcohol. And
let me ask you, you said the government's always spying on us. I've picked up a couple of tweakers and given them a ride before, and they've told me that. The FBI's in the trees up there. They're watching right now.
Yeah.
Did you really feel that way?
Well, I mean, I had tinfoil on my windows so nobody could see in, you know. The phone was being tapped. I mean, everything, you know. But I don't know if it was true at the time. I was just paranoid, you know. I'd be driving down the highway decoding license plates, you know.
Really? Were you a safe driver?
No.
Actually, one of his stories. He wasn't a safe driver.
Definitely not a safe driver. When I finally ended up getting sober and trying to clean up all the wreckage, I think I had 15 speeding tickets in a 2-year period, and they had taken my license, and it was kind of, yeah, it was a wreck. But anyway, so from very early, you know, as you know, young teenager through all the way up till I was 22, it was just kind of a mess of running and gunning, and you know, the substance would change. I mean, it was you know, meth at sometimes. There was always weed and alcohol. Once I was 15, 16, we started getting into opiates, Norcos and Vicodin, and turned into Oxycontin and fentanyl, and I mean, pretty much anything I could get my hands on.
So what you're saying is you're basically lucky to be alive today.
Yes. yeah, super grateful to be alive. Grateful that I was able to get out of that, you know, and unfortunately my parents didn't get out. You know, my dad died right when I was getting sober. He had been diagnosed with stage 4 throat cancer. He ended up passing away when I was a year sober. And then my mom actually, who was prescribed OxyContin, overdosed and died on it when I was about 4 years sober. So it was really sad to see that they weren't able to get out of the lifestyle that we were in. So
now, was there other siblings in the household that were also exposed to this whole thing?
Yeah. So I have an older brother. So we grew up together. We were always, I mean, we fought a lot because we're brothers, but I mean, we were always running and kind of, you know, living that lifestyle together. And he didn't get out when I did. So I got sober back in 2010 because of the court system. And we'll kind of get into that, you know, and some of the consequences that I had, but he ended up not really being able to turn his life around until about 5 years ago. It was when he finally was able to kind of get in enough trouble to have some consequences to where he started changing his lifestyle. So,
wow. Now, when you were in the system, you and I have had conversations at the office just because your stories are, it's one of those things that's almost there. You can't believe the stories he tells. I mean, tell one about, and he may be able to relate here, about it getting into a high-speed chase. Rolls the car.
I thought I was on Fast and the Furious, you know?
Well, did you really?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that was my thought process at the time was, well, I've seen this on the movies, you know? I mean, I can make this work, too, you know? It didn't work out.
Well, you know, there's a lot of theory to that kids are living their lives through the Internet, and they bring it out into the world, real world. There was that guy that hacked that guy to death with a splitting ball in Mountain Gate and then went over, or somebody tried to interfere, and he wound up knocking him out, pouring gas on him, and burning him up. And he was relating to a video game he'd been playing.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes, and he's down in Wackyville for life.
Wow.
In prison, but he killed, you know, and that's why I asked that if you're really spun, do you really think you're playing a game?
Well, no, I don't think I was playing a game. That was just that I idolized or looked up to the rappers and the, you know, all that lifestyle in general. So I didn't think I was in a game, but that type of lifestyle, that whatever that looks like, you know, the running and gunning and fast cars and chasing and money and all that, that's what I was after. And I had the mindset of nobody. It was actually someone had done a home invasion and robbed me, and I was trying to chase them down. And so some things happened. And so I was of the mindset, no one's going to come into my house and do that. Like, I'm going to get them, you know. And unfortunately, they got away, and I went to jail. So,
Or fortunately,
at the time it was that far. I was pretty mad. You know, I was pretty
mad. You should have called 911 and hid in the bathroom till the police got there.
Yeah,
you wouldn't have gotten in trouble.
Well, the police did get there, and I did get in trouble. They found a few things I probably shouldn't have had at the time, you know. So,
well, now you had told me in one of the conversations that there was a point where you were like party central. That, you know, people would call you and you'd go to Red Bluff and deliver and this and that. I mean, the second part of the show, we'll talk about the recovery and everything else, but how did you go from being a kid who's selling little baggies to all of a sudden being like almost a bona fide big dealer in Shasta and Tama counties?
Yeah. Well, I think it was just I loved the attention. I think we all crave some kind of identity or some kind of attention. You know, we're all seeking something, you know, and for me, you know, we always grew up very poor. We never had enough. We were always on food stamps and getting evicted and cars getting repoed. And it was just a really, you know, sad way to live, especially back in South Dakota. It's cold, you know.
Oh, that was
cold
back there.
It's cold back there in the winter, you know.
Sure.
And then we moved out here. And so I was driven probably somewhat financially, you know, to say, hey, like, I don't like not having money for clothes. You know, I remember being young and there were times where my parents would be like, hey, do you want to get another bag or do you want to get new school clothes? You know, or do you want to go grocery shopping or do you want to get some more? You know, it was always, do you want to get some more or do you want to get school? You know, it was always, we always wanted to get high.
Kind of a binary. You know? So we either get high or get something useful.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I always wanted to get high.
Oh, geez.
You know, I didn't care about, see, that's the thing when you're in an addiction and when you're living that, you don't care about clothes and food and, you know, a lot, at least for me, the type of addict I was, I didn't care about a lot of things. I just wanted to get high.
Are you talking methamphetamine then?
You know, smoking weed and then opiates were a big part.
Let me ask you this now. You've been clean and sober for 10 years?
12.
12. Do you have a little urge once in a while?
No.
That's good. I smoked for 35 years. I quit probably about 15 years ago. And once in a while, I'll smell the smell of smoke, and, oh, that smells good.
Yeah.
But I keep going. And I had somebody tell me, too, using heroin, you don't just play with heroin. That urge never goes away. It's always hidden back there. That's what I was curious about.
So you might have an urge or a thought, but through the recovery process and through working steps in my life, because I've worked the 12 steps, and I don't want to get into all that right now, but I have been relieved of the obsession, because it was every day from the time I woke up till the time I went to bed, if I went to bed, that was all I thought. And so through getting sober and through going through a 12-step program and working the steps, I have been relieved of that obsession. I no longer have a desire to get drunk or high on a daily basis, or, you know, so things can come up, but it's no longer a solution. See, that's where I think some of the misconception is a lot. It's not just drugs and alcohol are the problem. I was the problem too. And my solution for a long time was drugs and alcohol. That's what helped me cope with life. That's what helped me deal with my parents and deal with the things that I was going through. And for a while it worked and it was a lot of fun. You know, but it got to a point to where this is no longer fun. This is something I can't live without, and I'm going to do anything and everything I can to get this on a daily basis. And that's when, you know, you start doing a lot of things that you're not very happy about.
Well, you had just relayed something that is kind of funny. And when you look at it kind of from above, you started to tell a little bit of a story about how somebody broke into your house and you were pissed off. Did – when you were in your throes of the addiction. Now, were you kind of a criminal, or did you just focus on the drug selling? I mean, so it's kind of funny that you were calling a criminal when you were a criminal yourself.
I like to think I had some morals, you know,
depending on the subject.
In most cases, I wasn't out intentionally like robbing and stealing from people or places, you know. Now, I would be what you would probably call like a petty theft, you know, like gas stations and stuff like that. Like there'd be times where I just didn't care and I didn't want to pay for things, which through getting sober, I went out and made financial amends to a lot of these places, you know, so I've gone and paid those back. But
were they appreciative when you showed up and explained to them and gave them their money?
You know, I actually thought one guy was going to beat me up.
Yeah.
It was outside of Chico, and I went in and I said, hey, this is, you know, I was wrong. This is who I used to be. This is what I did. I owe you this amount. And he got up, and I thought he was going to jump over the counter and start whooping on me, you know. And I said, hey, man, I'm just trying to make this right. Like, here's your money. And he said, okay, don't ever come back. And I said, okay. But outside of that, most of the time, most people were open and just happy to see you doing better.
Yes.
Now, with one of the stories that you relayed that is – it's funny, before, you know, we end up getting break here in a couple minutes, is you tell the story about you – I think it was after your last bust, and you you're lying with something. You know, your mom was in bad health, and you said such and such and such. It was not a good look.
I
would love to tell that story, because it is kind of, when he made the comment, I could not help but laugh out loud.
Yeah, so I had, I was through high school and through my early, you know, running and gunning, I was of the mindset, they're never going to catch me. I'm too slick. I'm too cool. I'm too, you know, they're not going to catch me. And, after being in jail and I was on probation for over 5 years, you know, and been in jail before, and I went to jail again, and my girlfriend had called me, and my mom had overdosed again. She was still alive, but she had overdosed, and she was in the ICU, and I'm in there, and I'm looking at going to prison for a while, and I was crying. I mean, I'm crying, you know, I'm crying in jail, and it is not a good look, you know, like Doug was saying, like, I'm not very big, I have red hair, and I'm crying in jail.
And you're in the same cell as Big Bubba.
Big Bubba's in there, you know. So, so leading up to that was when I went to court, you know, and I don't know if you want to get into that after the break or not, but yeah.
I want to connect to you up front. Is this, you know, the process that got you to the moment when the light went on? And so this first part is just kind of the stories and what did you do and how did you get into it? And, you know, how were you able to constantly avoid the police for so long? I mean, you were getting caught, but you never seemed to get caught. Let's put it that way. So how did you do that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I think there's a lot of us out there that are doing what I was doing.
I would say, you know, there's a lot. Yes.
There's a lot. Probably more today than back when I was doing it. And even back when I was doing it, there was a lot steeper consequences, which those two probably go hand in hand. But, you know, I don't think – I mean, there are laws and stuff in place to where they can't just go rage or do whatever. You know, they can't just follow you around all day, every day.
But
you
were convinced while you were out there, they were all looking for you and they were going to pull you over every time you saw a cop.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't want to have one behind you, that's for sure. You know, and it got to a point to where I wouldn't even want to leave the house. You know, I just have people come. You know, come to the house.
Oh, so you were one of those houses that the neighbors all saw the traffic all day and all night.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
No kidding.
Absolutely, yeah. And see, at that time, even for part of that, I was on probation and I was, they could come search me anytime, but I thought I was really slick because they aren't going to find anything, you know, but really they just never came.
Were the neighbors friendly towards you?
Depended on the neighbor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what they needed that day.
Yeah. Depended on the neighbor. You know, there was, you know, some neighbors that were in the same lifestyle, you know, and I think we can all agree, you know, there are certain neighborhoods and certain locations where that lifestyle is very normal. So you're not going to get a lot of pushback from the neighbors.
Oh, sure.
You
Absolutely.
Know, like the neighborhood I live in today, you'd probably get a little pushback, you know, based on what I was doing, you know, taking apart my stereo at 3 a.m. in the car. You know,
I'm getting pushed back to my neighborhood now because I'm a conservative.
Yeah.
Well, that's almost as bad as doing what Adam was doing in today's world.
In my neighborhood, it is.
So, you know, Adam, at the bottom of the bottom, because we've got a break in about a minute and a half or so, at the bottom of the bottom, what was that like every day? I mean, did you not sleep? Did you get, I mean, when you were at the bottom, because then on the second half of the show, I want to talk, and that's what Nick and I really wanted you on for, is that you went to the travel of hell down, and then on the backside, we want to work it back up and find out if there's some things that people in the system can do. I mean, when you were at the bottom of the bottom, how did life look for you?
Yeah, so the last 6 months, I'll just talk about the last 6 months, was jail, homelessness, squatting in a house. The guy trying to evict me, needle in my arm every day, several times a day, just out trying to find the next fix, you know, and it was like you were saying, it was hell. I mean, I remember there was this period of going from, like, having a lot and then getting robbed and then going to jail and then having nothing and being in the process of my landlord kicking me out and trying to tell him, you can't kick me out. You know, I was one of those guys,
even
you know,
though I haven't paid the rent in
yeah,
6 months.
Exactly.
I'm not going to get a job.
And this is 2008 and 2009. So you got to understand, I didn't know back then, but apparently we were in a housing crisis,
yes,
you know, and there was a
yes.
lot of people losing everything, and I didn't know that. I'm in my own world telling him, you don't know who I am. I'm not going to pay the rent, and I'm not going anywhere, you know.
I'm Adam Schwartz. You're not going to tell me what the hell to do.
So it was. So there was definitely some of that, but there was, I mean, it was just it was hard waking up. It was hard getting up in the morning. It was hard going to bed. It was, if I did go to bed, it was just a constant out trying to find the next fix and out trying to just trying to survive and trying to, I had a girlfriend at the time and we were, you know, it was just living in my car, you know, and having everything in my car and you haven't showered in days and you haven't shaved and you haven't brushed your teeth and you're just, you know, you're just living. It's just gross, you know?
Yeah.
Like I'm so grateful today for a hot shower. I can go shower twice a day if I want to. Hot shower anytime I want. You know, back then there was no shower. It was the car.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, going from park to park. You know, just trying to find, trying not to have a cop drive by when you're trying to get loaded in the car.
How'd you feel about people giving you the stink eye? You know, normal people at the park.
Back in the day.
Oh, I didn't care. I wore it as a badge of honor.
Is that so?
I wore it as, you know, if I had track marks or I had this or I had that, I mean, it didn't matter. I didn't care what you guys thought of me. I, you know, it didn't bother me at all. Didn't bother me at all.
Are we ready for a break there, Liam?
We are. So we'll be back, and now we're going to start the rehab and the correction, shall we call it. So be back in a couple.
Here's a little jingle from the Thule Kids.
You can play it, you can pause it, you can skip it, you can stop it with a hop. When the hopper takes over your commercial, the hop with the hop. Where the apps are the tools and the music is the stimulus with the hop. All the cats and chicks can get their kids with the hop. Let's go!
Thank you for calling BNT Satellite at 241-3474. That's 241-DISH. Hi, this is Doug Tooley. Are you missing Newsmax? Call me because I make TV easy and I can get it back for you. My phone number is 241-3474. In case you didn't hear that, that's 530-241-3474. Or visit us at 1007 Dana Drive, Redding, California. Check us out on the internet at btsatellite.com. Shasta County's only DISH Premier retailer. Restrictions apply. Call for details.
KCNR Shasta is also broadcasting at K243CT Redding.
On display now at Turtle Bay Museum, Honor, Courage, Commitment, Marine Corps Art, 1975 through 2018, featuring 36 art pieces created by Marine combat artists who documented their own experience in times of war and peace. This traveling museum exhibition is sponsored by the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation from the National Museum of the Marine Corps. Open now through April 30th. Honor, Courage, Commitment, Marine Corps Art at Turtle Bay Museum. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Here we are back again. Listen, this is Nick. Every once in a while, I come up with quite a few bright ideas. Every once in a while, one of them sticks.
Shut up. No way.
A month and a half ago, Matt Nemel and Liberty Unabashed left the radio station, so that left a void. And Doug and I are filling that every week now, but neither one of us wanted to give up our weekends, all of our weekends, in good weather. So I came up with the idea that maybe Kevin Cry would like to come on and do a show every other week. I ran it by Carl. I ran it by Doug. They thought it was a good idea. I ran it by Kevin, and he said yes. So in March, and the date's not set, it's either March 5th or March 12th, Kevin Cry will start his new show every other Sunday here at the same time, 8 to 9 a.m., and my hope is we're going to get an inside view of what's going on with the supervisors in certain situations, but it's Kevin's show and he can talk about anything he wants to.
I think it's a great idea because that's, you know, I've said it before, and one of the most misused words in the English language since Obama for sure is transparency. We're being very transparent, and yet there's a wall of opaqueness that never gets to be seen. So hopefully having him on the radio, we can actually lift the skirt, so to speak, and see what the heck's going on behind the scenes that he can tell us. Because, of course, there's going to be things that are confidential. But I think it's a great thing to have somebody who's in there, in the meat grinder, giving an every other week kind of update what's going on and give listeners a chance to give him direct feedback.
I found Kevin to be very well-rounded, not a one side or that side. He sees the whole picture. And I think it'll be an interesting show. I came to the station the other day, and there was a package for me, and it turned out to be a money clip with a Liberty dollar on it with the bell facing me, the Bell of Liberty. But there's a crack in it, and I wonder if James was trying to send me a message about that crack.
Well, or maybe that you're mentally cracked.
I'm
referring to that.
I just want to say thank you so much, James. I appreciate that very, very much. Thank you.
Well, there you go. Great. Well, folks, you've heard the first 30 minutes, and now we're going to go to, I guess it'd be called recovery. I don't want to use the word redemption, but, you know, rebuilding, I guess, would be more the thing. And so, Adam, as we start this second half, the goal is, you know, tell us about what was the event that got you to the moment. which changed your life and got you to this radio station today. So what was that event final that was the big one that said, this has got to stop?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's awesome. Kevin's going to come on. You know, I've met Kevin a few times and I know him. I think he's an awesome guy, you know, so that'll be good. So at the end, so I was in trouble. I've been in and out of the court system, mainly in trying to stay out and trying not to get caught again. But I'd gotten in trouble one more time. I was trying to get into rehab because they were sending me to prison. That was what the judge said. You know, my attorney said, hey, we're going to prison. And now this is 12 years ago. So stuff I was in trouble going to prison for today isn't even a slap on the wrist.
You know, let that sink in, folks. 12 years ago, he was having consequences, and today it wouldn't have even been a citation.
I wouldn't even got a citation. So I'm looking at going to prison. And like I mentioned earlier, I'm not very big, and I have red hair, and I'd be scared of going to prison. You know, and I really didn't want to do that, but I couldn't get out of it. I couldn't stop using. I couldn't stop what I was doing. And I had gotten arrested over in Humboldt County, so I'd been on probation in five counties. At the end of this, I was in probation in Shasta, Trinity, Tehama, Siskiyou, and Humboldt County. I was on probation in all five counties.
Wow, you got around.
I was a traveler.
A mobile business.
It's mobile. But I had gotten, when I got in trouble over in Humboldt County, I was on felony probation here in Shasta, and I had already gone to court, and they told me you need to get into rehab, you need to do these things, and we might not send you to prison if you get into a rehab that's a year or longer. And I didn't do that. I'd gotten in trouble again, and I went to court, and the judge said, hey, you got arrested again, and you have four more charges. And I looked at him dumbfounded because I had no idea what he was talking about, you know. But 2 weeks ago, I had gotten arrested in Humboldt, and I said, oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
They just added up, so like
it
trophies.
Did, yeah, it wasn't, you know. So what happened is they arrested me at court, and I went to jail, and I was in there for about 30 days. So I had been a serious addict up until this point. I mean, every day of my life I had been using and, you know, I couldn't go without it. Previously, about 6 months before this, when I got arrested, I was in jail for about 2 weeks. I was going through the worst withdrawals. I mean, I couldn't even get out of bed. You know, I couldn't eat. I couldn't do anything for the first week I was in there. I couldn't get off the toilet. You know, it was brutal. And I was in there and I was praying to God, just get me out of this. I'll quit. I'll go back. I'm from South Dakota. I'd go back. I'll go work on the farm with my aunt and uncle. They're good, you know, Catholics. You know, I'll go to church with them every Sunday. Like, I was praying, like, please just get me out of this. And because I was also in trouble in Shasta County, after 2 weeks, they actually took me out of Tehama County, brought me to Shasta County. But even 12 years ago, they would still not hold you very long. So I got released the moment I got into Shasta County, and even though I was praying and doing all this stuff while I was in jail, within 30 minutes of getting out, I had a needle in my arm again.
Wow. Wow.
And it just started that. So fast forward 6 months down the road, I had lost my house, and I'd been homeless and living in my car and doing all this stuff, and I wasn't ready to change. I did not have a desire to change the way I was living. But I went to Humboldt, got arrested out there, and then I came to court down here. And this time when I was at court and they said these things, they said, hey, well, you're going to jail. And so I get remanded, and I have court a couple weeks later. And in between then was when I got the call from – I talked to my girlfriend, and my mom had overdosed, and she's on ICU, and we don't know if she's going to make it. And my dad had been diagnosed with stage 4 throat cancer by that time. So I'm really broken inside. I mean, I'm going through withdrawals again. I have no idea when I'm getting out, if I'm getting out. I have some charges in Tehama County that were pretty serious. I hadn't even gone to court for yet. I have these charges in Shasta County that I'm in trouble for. So I was looking at, you know, probably a minimum of 5 years in prison total.
Wow.
Possibly more than that. And we don't know if my mom's going to live, and my dad's got cancer, and I'm broken, and I'm crying. And a guy that I was in jail with me, and I won't get into this super deep, but he came up and he said, you know who God is? And I said, no, I don't have any relationship with God. He said, you can say this prayer and he'll be with you. And so I said the prayer and I turned my life over, you know, and he gave me a Bible and I started reading it, and I went to court a week later, and they told me, they said, you have two options. They said, if you take the deal we're going to give you, you'll do 18 months. But if you try to fight it and you don't want to go to prison and you do this hearing and you lose, then we're going to give you the full, which was 3 years just for my stuff, Jessica. I hadn't even gone to court in Tam County yet. And I said, no, I don't. I said, no, I don't want to go to prison. Like, I'm not going to just take a deal. Like, I want to do the hearing. And I go to the hearing, and the DA said, look at all these charges. Look at all the trouble. He's a repeat offender. He's constantly doing all this stuff. We want to send him to prison. Probation. Probation was there. They said the same thing. We want to send him to prison. And the judge, he's no longer a judge, but the judge at the time believed in the program that the mission had. They had an 18-month recovery program, and he believed in, and that's what I was asking for. I was asking, please, you know, can you send me to this program so I can have a chance to turn my life around? I really think if I do that, I'll be better off. If you send me to prison, I'll probably get worse. I mean, realistically, I'm probably going to meet some new connects in there, and I'm probably going to, you know. And so
you're going to expand your business empire.
Yeah, my business is going to thrive, you know. So in that case, the judge actually overruled the DA in probation and allowed me to go to a program. I was court mandated to go, and what he told me is if you do not complete this program, you don't get another hearing, you're going straight to prison. So I had a little bit of pressure, you know. I still wasn't ready to change. I just didn't want to go to prison. But he let me out, and I went to the program, and I graduated that program successfully, and I've been sober ever since. So I'm super grateful. My life is nothing like it was then. I'm married and have kids, and my kids have never seen me loaded, you know, and now my brother, you know, has turned his life around, and he's doing good, you know. So it's just a miracle what can happen when things are in place to allow you to get to a place to change.
Let me ask you, do you think God had a part in it also?
Oh, God had a huge part. I give all the credit. He gets all the credit. You know?
How about this now? Do you think it can be successful without God? Programs.
That's a tough question. So
okay,
for
well,
me,
that's fine.
For me, no. For me, I don't believe so. And I believe for a large majority that we need God or a higher power if someone has trouble with the God aspect. But I also believe there's so many people that are so broken like I was that early on we can't even have a concept of what God looks like. And I've been sober a while and I've worked with a lot of people trying to get sober, and most of us have a resentment against God.
You know, I used to do the windows 20 years ago for a place called Reverend Ray's, and it was a Christian bookstore over on Hilltop.
Oh.
And he was an old Charles Manson-looking guy, and he told me, he says, the only way to get tweakers off crank is through Jesus.
Wow.
And he had ex-addicts in there, and they would talk to me, and that was an awful strong incentive that helped them.
Well, yeah. And bringing this back full circle, the reason we've got Adam on today is Nick and I have been kicking around and kicking the whole jail concept to the curb because Sheriff Johnson wants to do this gigantic campus out on Old Oregon Trail where there's like this forced rehabilitation, forced this, and Nick and I just, you know, you can't force people. So I guess the question, Adam, is if the system was just forcing you, would it have stuck, or is it finally you said enough was enough?
Well, it sounds to me like the system put some pressure on you rather than
absolutely.
Forced you.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I didn't have to do what they said, and
it wasn't a government program though. That's also something to keep in mind. Programs like the government just don't work. So this was the government put a little bit of pressure on you, and you decided.
Right. So it wasn't something they had in place. It was an outside, a separate, you know, it was the Good News Rescue Mission. They have a recovery program that worked and still works hand in hand with, you know, the court system. And they gave me a safe place to go that I could, you know, have a chance to turn my life around. So I do believe there's a balancing act it's not the same for every person. You know, different people are at different phases of their addiction and different phases of their life. But starting from the top, if there's no consequences, if there's nothing that's going to happen based on my actions, that if I'm out here running and getting loaded and stealing stuff and just able to kind of keep doing whatever I want to do without any consequences, it's going to be really hard to have people want to change because they're not seeing any consequences.
And besides that, we should face it, that's kind of a fun lifestyle.
Well, I mean, it's fun and miserable. When you're in it. It's fun and miserable at the same time. I mean, you can have a lot of fun, but you can also be really miserable. You know, I mean, there's a lot of people I see out there that aren't having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of people not having a lot of fun. There's a lot of people that are miserable that need help. There's a lot of people that want help and still can't get it. Well, I've been around long enough to see people that are trying to get sober, that are trying to turn their life around, that are trying to get it, and they just can't get out of it, and they end up overdosing or getting shot or dying. You know, I mean, that's the reality of that life.
Let me butt in here. I was at the city council meeting this last Tuesday, and there was probably 12 people that came up from the recovery system at the Goodwill Net Rescue Mission, and most of them, all they wanted to say was, thank you, Redding, for giving the money to finance this program. And then Jonathan Anderson got up there and talked, and that's fine and dandy. So I went out, and I talked to somebody in authority out in the hall, and I said, I know a gal that worked in recovery systems, and she told me that the success rate of them is anywhere from 5 to 15%. I said, is that the same thing with the Goodwill Rescue Mission? And he said, well, it might not quite be that bad, but they have a lot of failure. So.
Well, I mean, now, Adam, I mean, you know, there was some pressure. You found God. But is there any practical thing that you can think off the top of your head, a step or three, because like I said, if the government is going to try and impose this, if the sheriff wants to have a forced drug center and psych center and this and that, government has never, I mean, you know, it's like Ronald Reagan says, you know, I'm from the government, I'm here to help you, you shouldn't run.
Yeah.
Do you have anything that, you know, looking back or even now that you're dealing with folks and helping them that they could do? Government-wise, because unfortunately it's the government, the private sector can't pick it up, but is there anything the government can do that would help? I mean, like, not try to do it with government, but contract with maybe private entities.
Yes, and I believe they do to some aspect, but as the laws and kind of the rules around it kind of loosen, so they're the court, from what I understand, you know, they're no longer allowed to do some of the things they did. Like how they told me, hey, you're going to go to this program, you're going to graduate, otherwise we're going to send you to prison. I don't believe there's still a place where they can do that.
Well, they're closing the darn prison, one of the two up in Susanville, so they're even
exactly,
making that less exactly, of a problem.
And they're prioritizing less, you know, what that looks like once people are in the system. You know, it's no longer let's have consequences, let's get these people better. I think it's just let's kind of put it to the side and we don't want to deal with it. You know, we don't have the finances to deal with it is kind of what it seems like. So I believe there is benefits in trying to help and trying to have systems in place to help people that are struggling. What that looks like, we would have to sit down and figure out a better solution. But right now, what they're doing isn't working. And I know our local governments don't have a lot of control about being what's done on the state level, from what I understand. And so it's kind of like I have friends that are police officers and sheriffs and probation officers, and there's nothing that bothers them more than picking up the same people over and over and over again and seeing them get right back out. Or not even, you know, that bugs these guys. Like, they don't want to do it. Like, that's why we're having a hard time having more sheriffs and more police officers. More people want to do that line of work because it's just they're doing the same thing over and over, and the people aren't getting in any trouble.
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons that I started advocating for a bigger jail quite a while ago, because that would alleviate the problem of the police dealing with the same people over and over again.
At least for a time, you know, if we can get them locked up, you know, because like you said, you were in for a month and you were going through withdrawals. I don't know. It's such a loaded thing because these people, you know, these advocates that they use as consultants weren't in the system, most of them. They went to school and got a degree and they know what the book told them to do. But yes, Folks like yourself who have been through it, I mean, that's something that, as I mentioned for Kevin Cry, maybe have Adam and some folks like them talk to you about things you can maybe bring to the Board of Supervisors, because just listening to the consultants is not getting us anywhere.
Let me ask you this. You went to jail, and then you decide, how long does it take you to be in jail to clean up to where you can think, to where you want to make a change?
Yeah, well, for me, it was within the 30 days. I mean, okay. I was in there 30 days, but I was funny as it sounds, I was talking to some of the old-timers that were in jail that had been in and out their whole life, and they're saying, man, you don't want to be like us. If you can get this program, get out and do it, turn your life around. And where the change happened for me was when I went to that program, and I had seen guys that had spent their whole life in prison, their whole life running a gun, and their whole life living that lifestyle, and they had been sober a year or longer, and they're working, and they have their family back, and they're and I'm thinking, man, I didn't even know this was possible. I had no idea you could stop living the way I was living and have this amazing life. So it was seeing the hope in other people. It was seeing the other people get out of this system and turn their life around that gave me hope. That made me. That's when it changed. So my first 30 days in jail. First probably 30 to 45 days in rehab, I still wasn't ready to change. But then something clicked when I finally realized, like, these guys are actually staying sober and doing the deal. Like, I don't have to go back to what I was doing. And that's where it changed for me, was seeing the other success stories. So there is something in that, too. And I'm a big advocate for there's a ton of recovery in our community. There's a ton of programs. I'm not going to get into them because they're anonymous, but there are a ton of programs out there, and there's a ton of meetings, and there's a ton of recovery in Shasta County and people that want to see other people do well.
But you know? But the perpetrator, i.e. you have to – well, and I mean that is yeah. – I mean you have to want it though. You know,
you have to want it.
If you don't, if you're not at that, you know, you always watch those shows or those things about, you know, people who are in addictions, and until they get to the bottom of that barrel, they're not ready to make that switch. And you got there, and you're saying there are a lot of programs in Shasta County that do help those, but how do the folks get into it? Is it they finally go to the judge and say, I need help, and then the rescue mm-hmm. mission, or is there like a whole arm of the government that's kind of doing that?
Is there one place you can go to get referred to the programs? You walk in and say, I'm a tweaker, I want to change. What do we got? Well, that's kind of rude, crude, and socially unacceptable.
No, not at all. So I think, one, that's a very hard thing to do. I don't know very many people that come walking in off the street that say, hey, I'm a tweaker and I need help. Or I'm an alcoholic, or I'm a heroin addict, like I want help. Most of the people that are in that situation, they are on probation, or they're in some kind of system, or their family is begging them, you know. I was just having lunch with someone the other day, and you know, the 12-year-old girl was talking about how she had just caught her mom with fentanyl and heroin and getting loaded, and she's supposed to be going into rehab. So it's sad. It's a sad situation.
Sure.
And not a lot of people want it, but there are plenty of programs out there. I mean, you could Google recovery or 12 steps or anything like that, and you could find a system. But I do believe there is a benefit in a court system that puts pressure on people to get into these. And if you don't at least make the effort, then you're going to have some consequences. So you had mentioned, how long does it take? So I'm a big believer in like a 60 or 90 day, get them off the streets and off out of their addiction, you know, 2 to 3 months and you know, in whether it's jail or whatever, to where they can get their mind clear, they can get the drugs out of their system, they can be finally in a place to where they're not craving it. And because you get it, you're in for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days and you get let out, if that. You're going right back out. There's no, you know, I mean, I was in for 2 weeks and I went right back out. But that 30, 60, 90 day mark definitely, I think, gets people dry enough, long enough to at least think about wanting to change. Because like you said, you have to want it in yeah. order to get it.
And I think that's what the current proposal. I appreciate Chris and Patrick and them wanting to do a new jail, but we don't have the personnel. And, you know, you still got to have consequences. You can't just have a bigger jail and just put people in there if there's not going to be something that's going to kind of have, you know, the carrot and stick theory. And that's what we're missing.
Well, you know, I think the
courts... But I think we need to get them off the street, though. So there you go.
The courts and the rehab should be separated. Mm-hmm. I think the courts should put them in jail with the new jails. And when they're approaching the end of their sentence... Have the rehab people, the counselors, come in and say, this is what we can do for you. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It looks like there's about four things that really contribute to a recovery. One is hitting bottom, but you've got to want it. But God, Jesus, religion is one. Pressure from the courts is another. Pressure from your peers, your fellow jailmates. And then a good rehab program. And it might work. What, 25% of the time?
It might. Well, and that's the tough part is I'm a big believer in the 12 steps.
Okay.
And for me, that was what allowed me to change the way I thought.
Yes.
And I know a lot of rehabs implement those, but I've also seen people come off the streets and turn their life around just by doing the 12 steps. So there is power in doing that and getting... You know, someone that can take you through those and allowing you to, and they're in order for a reason, you know, and the God thing, we can figure that out as we go. It's a big hoop.
Sure.
Right? We don't have to figure that out right now. And that's one of the biggest things that I see is between like the faith-based rehabs and the other 12-step programs is I know people all day long that'll praise Jesus and that'll say, you know, quote Bible verses and do all this stuff, but they don't work the steps and then they're out getting loaded.
Sure.
A week later.
Sure.
You know, so for me, it's a combination.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just one or the other. Now, I do know people too that have said they've been a tweaker or a heroin addict their whole life and they met Jesus and he saved them and they were struck sober and they've never got loaded again. But from my experience being in this for 12 years, that's not the norm. That's not the norm. It's a process. It's going through the process of doing the steps to make you change, you know, that allow you to change.
So early on in the criminal process, if we had more consequences for people in their first contact with the law enforcement, that might be a better shortcut to getting them from the long-term thing that you went through. So like if early on in your distinguished career, had you had more consequences from the court early, it might have kept you away from it in the long run, you think?
Possibly. I don't want to say, you know, you got to hit bottom. You got to do, you know, but today, I can tell you today, there's nowhere near as much consequences as there was even back when I was doing that. So the fact that there's less consequences today, there's less things that the cops and really the jail can do today to hold people. So there has to be more consequences, I believe, or more, you know, things that we can put in place for when people are doing what they're doing, that it's like, okay, we're going to get you out of this and this is where you're going to go for 60 days or 90 days, whatever that looks like. That would definitely help. I see that making a huge difference.
Let me ask you this now. I've always thought that heroin addicts don't really cause problems except to get their heroin. If heroin was legalized, do you think we'd have as much problem with heroin addicts and or meth addicts?
I don't think legalizing is a solution. You know, I mean, you're still going to have problems. You're still going to have people, if they can't get it, they're going to be breaking the law.
Well, if they just go down to the clinic every day and get their fix.
Decriminalizing prevents overdoses, Nick. That's why we decriminalize drugs, is to prevent overdoses, so that people can get help when they want it down the line, and they don't die before that.
Well, I would be more for decriminalizing heroin to stop the crime.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care if somebody smokes pot. I don't care if they do heroin. It doesn't bother me. Just don't snot all over me.
Yeah, just don't steal
stuff. Don't slobber
stuff.
On us.
Well, Nick, our show is at near the end. I want to say thank you.
Fast.
It went too fast.
It went really fast. I feel like we didn't.
Yeah. Adam, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for giving us a peek into that world because we
need. And what do you do now for a living?
Yeah, so I sell real estate.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's a great realtor, so give him a buzz. But thank you for giving
us a Doug taught me everything I know.
But, you know, I taught my son everything I know, and he still doesn't know nothing.
Hey, have a great day, guys.
All right, thanks.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good. So good. I got you. Oh, I feel nice.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.